Well, it's great to see you tonight, and great to see so many of you. You are very, very welcome. It's quite a sober sort of issue we're going to be dealing with tonight again, but I think you'll enjoy and find it very interesting. And afterwards, we've slashed Jeremy's tyres, so he won't be going in a hurry. He'll stay around and chat. Sorry, it's just that he mentioned he'd recently been in Lancashire, so I was trying to learn from Lancastrians what they do, and that's one of the things. It's you are very, very welcome. And if you want to carry on drinking or nibbling, do feel free to pop out and get something more to eat. And we'd love you to stay around and chat. Now, tonight is going to be excellent. But tomorrow night, we have a chap called Billy McCurry, who, to be honest, was a terrorist. He was eventually sentenced at Her Majesty's pleasure because he was under the age of 18, so he didn't get a life sentence. For murdering a man. He literally looked in his eye and shot him dead. And the reason was, for years he'd been consumed with bitterness, because when he was just 11 or 12 years of age, his father was murdered by the IRA. It is an amazing story, and of course terrorism is such a big issue at the moment. And to try and understand what was going on, and then the total transformation that came about in his life in the Mays prison. It is one of the most remarkable stories I think you'll ever hear. And we'd love to see you tomorrow. Same time, probably the same food. If you don't eat it all tonight, it will be the same food. And do come along. And as I said last night, if you know an atheist and can bring him or her along, sit them down and then just say, before you listen to this, if there is no God, explain what you're about to hear, because it is a most amazing and inexplicable outside of God story. Anyway, that's tomorrow. And then on Saturday, wow, what? I don't know, this is a week of treats. A chap called Derek, who, again, a most dramatic story. His legs were blown off whilst fighting, I've forgotten whether it was Afghanistan or Iraq, which was it? But anyway, Afghanistan. And he's been here once before, and I think he only shared with the men then, and all the ladies felt really miffed. But normally church puts loads of things on for ladies and not much for men. But anyway, this time, I was joking, you all looked very serious. this time, everybody's welcome. That's on Saturday. I think on Friday, it's a youth meeting. But these days, you are what you feel, aren't you? So if you're 90 but feel young, you're very welcome. And if they challenge you at the door, just say, I feel as I'm a 17-year-old, and nobody will dare question it, so you're very welcome. And one other thing, sorry, Friday afternoon, oh, how could I forget this? What a treat. If you're at work, pull a sickie. Just come along on Friday afternoon, because we're going to have a Yorkshire tea event. And everybody who comes, unless there's a huge crowd, will get a free box of Yorkshire tea. I know that leaves some of you drooling already. And in the box is a little coupon which gets you 30p off your next box of Yorkshire tea. But anyway, and we're going to be talking about all things Yorkshire. Everybody's welcome. If you are Lancastrian, the church has got psychiatric help laid up at the back for you on Friday after. We'd love to see. What time is it on Friday? Right, it's 2 o'clock, but if you really want a place, you need to be here for 10:30, because there will be long, long queues down the high street. Anyway, you'll be very welcome. There we are, and then Sunday, etc. Now, the bookstore. I am a Yorkshireman, in case you didn't realise, and whenever I travel, books slip into the boot of my car, and I've brought them here. This isn't the church trying to get money out of you. This is all to do with me, and I don't make any profit on any of the books. It's a very strict rule of mine that I work as a traveling Christian speaker, and I'm not really, I don't want to be distracted into making money from books, but I do want to get out good Christian books, so they're really cheap. And again, if you're from Yorkshire, ooh, there'll be a big smile going across your face at the moment. Most of them are only £1 each, but the others, which are a bit more expensive, are greatly reduced. Let me just mention, this is not a Tupperware party, you don't have to buy anything, but they're there as a resource. Let me mention a few things, if I may. I would have liked a book for adults on the theme of facing death, because that's the issue we're going to talk about tonight particularly. And I've run out, I'm afraid. But this was written for children. It is lovely. It's just beautiful. It's on the theme of death. How do you explain death to a child when someone you know dies? Have a look inside. If you can have a little quick read of it, it'll bless your socks off, but it's really aimed at children. It's a lovely little £1 book. And then some of you will know the name Dr. Helen Rosevere. She was a missionary to what was called the Belgium Congo. And did an amazing work. She was a medical doctor, but incredible work. But in 1964, there was a rebellion, the Simba Rebellion, and many Western missionaries were murdered. She was captured. She was beaten. She was raped. She was taken out before a firing squad. She was sent back to prison. She was abused, etc. She only recently died, but just an amazing interesting woman. Her last book, though I think they're going to squeeze one more out of some of her writings, was called Enough. And if ever you or somebody else you know has been in the situation where you feel, I've just had enough, this is for you. It's a lovely book. That's just £1 as well. And then Night by Night, as you know, we're interviewing people. And this is a collection. I think this is the latest one? A collection of stories of people who've been interviewed. It's called A Passion for Life. And it contains, if I remember correctly, about 13 stories of people who've been interviewed telling their stories. So you get, who do you get? Jamie Jones Buchanan. Rugby player, professional rugby player. This isn't Mamby Pamby rugby, sorry, this is rugby league. And Fiona Castle, many of you know Fiona Castle, widow of Roy, of course. Peter Dungy, what a story that is, the immoral priest. Rob Dean, the submariner. Rachel Waddilove, she was on Good Morning Television last week, the nanny to celebs, etc. They're amazing stories, and then an explanation as to what it means to become a Christian. It's just £1, and again, it's at the back. And then because I realise we're south of Sheffield and £1 doesn't mean much to you down here, I thought I'd mention one that's a little bit more expensive and you've probably never seen it before, but they're imported specially. It's the one-year Christian history. It has 366 readings for every day of the year and just two pages, and on every page, it tells you something that happened in church history. What's today's date? Is it the June the 7th? Right. So did you know that on June the 7th, 1967, oh, right, this is to do with the Six-Day War, etc., and then it's got a Bible thought and an idea for prayer. And the whole book is just filled like this. It's fascinating. And it should be, if I remember correctly, $17, there we are, and it's here for £8. Oh, you're a miserable lot. That's a good deal. We'll leave that. I want to read a passage from the Bible, and then I'm going to interview Jeremy. And I want to read a full chapter, if I may. It's from a book called The Book of Job. Probably the oldest book in the world. Certainly the oldest book in the Bible. And I'd love to read the whole book to you. We can't do that. But let me read the first chapter and set the scene. And we'll come back to it later on, and you'll see how it relates to what we hear from Jeremy in a few moments. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. Well, I'm not surprised, but anyway, he was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthday, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going to and fro on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You've blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds have spread throughout the land. But now stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he'll surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then. Everything he has is in your power, but on the man himself do not lay a finger. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the eldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the Sabians attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the eldest brother's house when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they're dead, and I'm the only one who's escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Wow, what a chapter. I'd love to carry on reading, but it's time for me to introduce to you Jeremy. It's great to have you, Jeremy, and do join me. Let's give him a very warm welcome, shall we? Good to see you. Well, welcome. You look a little different from the photo up there.
That's things what chemotherapy does to your hairstyle.
Yeah. Oh, right. I just thought that was airbrushed, but no. You were once like that, were you?
That was only about 4 years ago, I think.
Really? Yeah. Well, let's find out about you. It's good of you to come. Where do you live? Where's home now?
Just around the N25, Sevenoaks.
Great. Okay, well, thanks for coming and joining us. Tell us a bit about your upbringing, your home, you know, how it all began, your family. I know your father was quite a character. Tell us a bit about them.
Yeah, my father's idea of a summer holiday recreation was to take us Bible smuggling behind the Iron Curtain.
Bible smuggling?
Yeah, so we thought that's what most people did on a summer holiday. And we used to pack up an old Austin 1800, if any of you... Some of you look old enough to remember that. One of British Leyland's most unsuccessful products, which is saying something. And put it full of Russian and or wherever we were going, Bibles. And, yeah, there were four of us under 10, and off we'd go behind the Iron Curtain, which was kind of interesting experience. My father used to get into sort of haggling with the border guards, so that they would say, "Have you got any Russian Bibles?" And he'd say, "Yeah, and under the Soviet constitution, you're allowed to bring them in for personal use." So the guards would say, "Well, how many have you got?" So he'd say, 50. Say, "Well, that's too many." So Dad would then get into a sort of bartering situation. In the end, they'd agree, OK, you can take in 25 or whatever. So we used to go to these churches. We were rather surprised to see this strange English family turn up, especially as my father spoke not a word of Russian. What was very striking, Roger, was that the people in those churches had every conceivable reason not to believe.
Right.
Because if you were in a church, just if you came into a church building like this, then there would be, you know, the KGB outside and they would take note, and very often the pastors were in Siberian labor camps, or the people in the church would be kicked out of their jobs or couldn't go to school or whatever. So that there was every human reason not to believe, and yet despite that, they had this really strong and fervent faith, which was very striking.
And how old were you when all this was happening?
Well, to start with, I was about 10. So it was between about 10 and 18.
You were very observant of everything that was going on. But so brought
I was
up in a,
I was a child prodigy, yeah.
Brought up in a Christian home, but that doesn't guarantee that you'll become a Christian.
No, not at all. In fact, I thought going to church was extremely boring, and I objected very strongly. And didn't want to come to church and thought it was a complete waste of time. And then one day, this wasn't some kind of dramatic experience like Paul on the road to Damascus, but it wasn't actually even in the church building. But I can't really put it any better than to say that I suddenly realised it was true. Now, lots of things about church, and if you're growing up in a church, you see this, can strike you as odd. And sorry to be blunt, but some of the people in church are odd, to be honest, yeah. I mean, some of the people here look a bit odd to me. Maybe. But I think the key question I would suggest is not, are people odd or not odd? The question is what the church has to say true or not? And the church may say all sorts of things about all sorts of things, but really the key thing that a proper church should tell people about is that Jesus Christ is God and that he is alive. So I would say somehow, again, it wasn't that I saw something, but suddenly it was, you know, as if I was blind, I suddenly realized actually Jesus is alive. When I was a teenager.
Okay, so you committed yourself to Christ, you trusted and started to follow him. And then we're going to jump a little bit. You ended up banking.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know whether you ever see Matt in the Daily Telegraph. He has a wonderful cartoon of a banker going to be fitted up by a bespoke tailor for a new suit. And the tailor says to the banker, does Sir want to line his own pockets? And... I'm sorry, but that's the sort of vision we have of bankers and politicians. But anyway, we better leave that today. But did you go into banking to make money?
Oh, no, I went in to help people and help society. If you believe that, you'll believe anything.
And you ended up as CEO of Hawes. It's a sort of private bank, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I would put it slightly more strongly than that, Roger. But yeah, it's a sort of a private...
You wouldn't want me as a customer, would you?
Well, I don't know. I haven't looked at your bank balance.
I can assure you, you wouldn't.
With your booming book sales, you might qualify. You know, I worked in the city. Actually, I've also worked in Switzerland, France and the US for Credit Suisse for 20-odd years. And then for the last 7 or 8 years, I was chief executive of a family-owned private bank in Fleet Street called C. Hoare & Co. And all the conceivable jokes you can make about that name I've heard.
Yes. Yeah.
H-O-A-R-E, not in another way.
Yeah, we believe
and,
you again.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place, founded in 1672, and very unusually it's still owned by the same family. It's now on the 11th generation, and after 340 years, they decided to have an experiment, so they brought in the first non-family chief executive, which was me, and it was really great fun, yeah.
And basically, people who bank there are millionaires?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, yeah.
Multi-millionaires?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah,
more,
okay,
yeah,
all right.
Right.
So,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
So you're meeting with interesting people?
Yes, yeah. That's
and they're not coming to you for a loan?
Sometimes they are, actually. A lot of wealthy people actually don't... I mean, I'm not trying to kind of... Get sympathy whipped up. Actually, quite short of cash. They have lots of assets, so that is actually quite a profitable line of business. So typically, private banks do both lend people money and then also help them invest and manage their money, all that kind of good stuff. It's a very good bank with also a very strong philanthropic tradition, which was kind of attractive to me. So the family have been very, you know, they give away a lot of their profits to charity, and they were very involved, for example, in the whole, I know he was a proud Yorkshireman, William Wilberforce, anti-slave trade.
Absolutely.
In fact, one of the family bought his house in Clapham. So the whole family have always had this sense of let's give away most of our profits, which is great.
And without joking now, you know... There are ethical issues, aren't there, to do with finance and capitalism and making money, etc. You're a Christian. Did you ever find that your Christian values came into conflict with your professional duties and responsibilities?
Only about once a day, I would say, yeah.
Did they? What sort of issues, Jeremy?
Well, I think, Hawes is maybe a bit different because there the family have a kind of basically decent ethos. But in general in the city... and nothing against Credit Suisse as opposed to anybody else. But yeah, there's a tremendous pressure to hit the bottom line. So I think that's been a bad change in the city over the period I started in 84. And then there was much more sense of, you know, yeah, we're here to make money, but we're also trying to do the right thing. We're trying to help the customer. And basically it became all about making money and squeezing the last sort of drop of profitability out. And those of you who work in the city, you know, can probably recognize this. This was a shift that went on. And also, if you're in the city, obviously money is the great god. And that's, you know, why people, otherwise, why work such long hours in miserable conditions? I mean, joking aside, why do people do it? Because they want to make money. So that, you know, pressure to hit the bottom line and the desire to make money has resulted in the kind of mess you saw in 2008. So I don't try and defend the industry I was in. I mean, there are lots of good people in it, but also lots of bad things. And as a country, we're still really suffering the effects of what happened in 2008.
Now, you're married and you've got children. How many children?
Yeah, three children, 23, 21 and 18 next week. And two are, one's just graduating at St Andrews. She's going to do a master's in bioethics. So right. she's got her mother's brains, fortunately. And then we've got two boys, one's at Lancaster. So, sorry to mention that, Roger.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, like, yeah. Do we mind not swearing in church?
Yeah, that's right. And this is going to get even worse, Roger. And the other one wants to go to Manchester as well. Yeah, I know. My brother-in-law's from Preston, so I can't. I know, it's terrible.
And presumably, as a family, you'd go to church. You'd be living as a Christian family. You'd read the Bible. You'd talk about the things of God, etc. Everything would appear pretty hunky dory for you.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come on to what happened next in a minute. But yeah, yes. Been married for 30 years. Next month, three lovely children. Never had a day in hospital. I don't think I even went to see the GP until I was 50, and then sort of everything began to change. But yeah, and I had a really, in many ways, idyllic, blessed life, a bit like Job. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Well, exactly. Yeah. Now, Jeremy, if you don't mind, sorry. Clearly, we know why you're here, and we know why this interview is happening, because two or three years ago, everything was to very dramatically and suddenly change. Yeah. What led up to that?
So it was actually nearly 5 years ago now.
Sorry.
Time flies when
it
you're
does.
Enjoying yourself.
Yes.
But if you read about a kind of crisis engulfing the NHS, I'm personally responsible for most of it. So if you got rid of me, then the NHS waiting list would suddenly melt away. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I just felt this. I felt and saw this small lump on my ribs. So being a typical man, I didn't want to do anything about it. But my wife and gents, when your wife tells you to do that, you should do it, said, go to the GP. So I said, yes, boss. So I went to the GP, and the GP said, oh, it's nothing to worry about. It's just a fatty lump. It's fine. But just to put your mind at rest. And then I imagine any of you dealing with cancer, you're probably familiar with this. What happens is you sort of go from person to person, and this little seed of doubt in your mind begins to grow and kind of become a kind of monstrous tree, because each person says, I'm not really sure what that is, actually. Let's do some more tests. So in the end, I ended up at the Marsden, which is a cancer hospital. So it's kind of, okay, you had cancer. But the prognosis seemed to be reasonably good. I don't like to do things by halves. So I ended up with a really rare type of cancer. I've actually, in the meantime, had another equally rare and unconnected type of cancer, which I'll come into in a minute. But it's not really a great conversation. I went to see a specialist the other day at the Marsden who said, Jeremy, you're a most interesting case. I've never seen anybody with your symptoms. It's like, oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, that's not really what you want to hear.
But that's you reflecting on it now. How did you feel when the C word was used?
Devastated. Yeah.
Were you?
Even though at the time they said, look, it is cancer, but it's curable. We've caught it early. It should be fine. But yeah, you feel this, sick feeling in your stomach, and you think, why me? And yeah, you're afraid. I mean, none of us want, please don't think I'm positioning myself as some kind of super spiritual person. No, I don't want to die. I want to live. I've got three children and a wife. I'd much rather live. In the Bible, Paul said, I don't really mind if I die. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. But Paul didn't have a family, so, and I'm not nowhere near as holy as Paul, so I would rather live. So yeah, it makes you feel
so were you
sick.
By yourself when you were told that?
No, my wife was with me. Yeah.
Okay.
But the oncologist was quite cheery. There's more of this story to come. But he said, it's fine. You have an excellent chance. Because you ask, what's the prognosis? So the oncologist at the Marsden said, no, it should be fine. I can't guarantee it, but, 90% we can deal with it. We got it early. So I went through two operations and radiotherapy. And they said, yeah, it's fine, it's all gone, you're fine. So then 2 years went by, and you go...
So you're still working at Horsburgh?
Oh, yeah, I didn't really stop at all, which may be stupid, but anyway, typical man, didn't want to stop. So kept going, and then every 3 months you'd go for a scan. And again, any of you have been through cancer or know people have been through cancer, you get this thing called scanxiety, which is if you put scan and anxiety together, because basically you feel very nervous when you're waiting for the results. You're sitting there, and you can kind of read the doctor's body language as well when he comes out to tell you, you know, to come through. Anyway, so 3 months, and I can remember the oncologist said to me, okay, that's more than 2 years now, you know, basically it's fine, in fact we'll see you in 6 months. So that was, that was just a little over 2 years ago. So I can remember the day, and these days seem to be kind of seared in your mind. So 31st of May 2015, unlike today, it was a warm summer's day. I was around at a friend's house, and it was really quite hot, so I just went to adjust my collar here. And I felt this lump like a golf ball on my collarbone.
You'd not felt it before?
I hadn't, no.
Okay.
So you think, oh, you know, something. Yeah, I was, it just, again, you're sort of, it's like the ground opening up. In fact, it was, you know, about 10 of us having dinner. And I just said, I'm sorry, I don't feel well, I have to go home. Because I just couldn't, I knew straight away what it was. I was so, yeah. It's like being punched in the face, really, to be honest. So, and this time when I went back to the hospital, to the Marsden, they said, yeah, you've had it, basically. You've got terminal cancer, you've got tumours everywhere. I know I don't look like that, but that's they show you the scans. It's quite funny, really. They can play around with these scans in 3D. My wife, who's a nurse, finds it fascinating.
Yeah,
I don't like, yeah, it's not very nice looking inside your own body.
And again, Jeanette, I just want to go back to that moment when they said, look, this is terminal.
So that was much worse than the first time. And the doctor said, yeah, you've got 6 to 18 months to live.
Although how long ago was that?
2 years ago.
Years ago.
So,
okay.
Yeah, thank you, God, I'm still alive. But yeah, that is really, really, really hard. And the most difficult thing is to have to go home and tell your children that.
I was going
to
say,
That is really awful.
And how did you tell them? You sat them down?
Yeah, you know what, God bless them, they're all so different. I mean, yeah, if you've got children, those of you, yeah. Our oldest son, bless him, he's a lovely guy, and he's a great kid. Well, they all are. But the first time I had cancer, anyway, he had a Taiwanese exchange student with him. And Nat was sort of looking after this guy and, you know, being a kind of good host. And I couldn't get Nat away. So in the end, I said, Nat, have you got a second? I've just got a problem with my iPad. Can you just come in the next room and give me a hand? So when I said, look, I've got cancer, blah, 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 blah. So I said, have you got any questions? And he said, so there's nothing wrong with your iPad then? But, yeah, that's the sort of one. In some ways, it's a lot easier to deal with than obviously floods of tears. But, yeah, that's very, very difficult.
Were they all children who were saying they were Christians?
Yeah, yeah. Even though, yeah, my wife as well, but it doesn't make it easy, Roger. It doesn't mean that it's not like an insurance policy where you can kind of, it's a serious, severe test of your faith. Do you really believe what you say you believe?
Well, you see, in the first time you said you asked yourself, why me? Did you feel this again? Did you feel angry towards God? Did you feel bitter? Did you feel cheated out of, you know, the possibility of a long life and maybe grandchildren and all the rest?
No, I felt afraid, to be honest.
Afraid of what?
Afraid of death. Yeah, and also the process of dying, which is kind of messy. I mean, my father died of cancer, and any of you who've been around people in hospices and stuff, it's pretty horrible at the end.
It is, yeah.
It's kind of ugly. So even though I like to compare it to Heathrow Airport. You know, you have to go through an awful experience at Heathrow, then you get on a nice plane and you go to some nice Caribbean or something. So, yeah, that's a bit like a hospice. You know, it's like the worst Terminal 3 at Heathrow or something.
So
yeah.
How have you, you know, you're here as a Christian. In your struggle with this, how have you resolved the issues in your mind?
Yeah. Well, do you know the most common thing that Jesus said to his followers, his disciples, was don't be afraid. So it's very human, isn't it, to be afraid? And in a way, I'd be stupid if I wasn't afraid. People used to say in war, there are only two type of people who are not afraid, which are, idiots or heroes. And there are most, you know, in war, we just had yesterday, wasn't it, D-Day? If you talk to veterans, which I've done, most people would tell you they were terrified out of their minds. So God if we're Christians, doesn't leave us on our own. And he has, you know, amazing promises in the Bible. For example, I will never leave you or forsake you. And I would say, which is slightly ironic, I guess, that since I've been really ill, I've had a much stronger experience of the presence and the power of the Lord Jesus than before I was ill, which is a sort of paradox, isn't it? Maybe God is sort of whacking me over the head to say, you know, pay attention, Jeremy. So I never felt angry with God. I guess it's a question for me, it's a question of trust. So I do believe that God's in control of everything, as we saw in Job. I mean, God allows evil to happen. He certainly doesn't cause evil, but we live in an evil world. If we look at what happened on London Bridge on Saturday, the world is full of evil, and there's people evil and there's cell evil. In a way, I think the cell evil is actually easier to cope with than the people evil, because, you know, cancer isn't personal versus somebody, you know, driving into people and stabbing them. So I never felt angry with God, but I guess the question was, do I really trust God? And, you know, for me, it's maybe like, imagine if you went out of here with a small child and you were standing on the pavement. It's a fairly busy road. I can see the bus going up and down. And you have a, you know, two-year-old, three-year-old child, and you take the child by the hand and you walk across the road. Well, in that analogy, God is the parent and we're the child, because the question is, do we trust him? Does he know what he's doing? And the Bible tells us that yes, he does, and that he will bring us to the other side. And there's a story in the Bible where Jesus is in a boat with his disciples and he's fast asleep because he's tired. And this tremendous storm brews up, and they think they're going to drown, and they sort of kick or push Jesus roughly and say, you know, wake up, don't you care, we're going to drown. And they're afraid. And Jesus gets up, and he rebukes the wind and the waves, and suddenly it's dead calm, which if you sail, you know, doesn't happen. If the wind drops, the waves don't drop. Then it says, actually, they were even more afraid. So their fear was actually greater after the storm than before, because it suddenly began to dawn on them who Jesus was. So being a Christian, then, I think, if you like, and facing death, is a bit like having Jesus in your boat. It's not a guarantee that your boat won't sink. And friends, eventually everybody's boat is going to sink. Everybody will die. You know, sorry to be blunt, the death rate in this room is 100%. If any of you think you're immortal, you might want to have a word to Roger or me afterwards. But if we have Jesus in our boat, then he will bring us to the other side. He will bring us to himself, and he will save us. Not just, you know, he will save us eternally. I mean, that's what Jesus came to offer us, which is eternal life.
Again, putting it bluntly, you're living on extra time, aren't you, at the moment.
It's a bit like in a Champions League when you get extra, extra minutes.
And do you sense your mortality more than before? Are you conscious each day that, oh, wow, this is a very precious gift in a way that perhaps you weren't before?
Yeah. Especially I've had all kinds of other medical problems as well, which we can
Job faced, if we carried on reading, there was worse to come. And you've had other issues with your eyesight.
Yeah, especially this year hasn't been so bad so far. I'm just about to start chemo again in 2 weeks. Actually, the timing of this is good. I've been through chemo twice. Your hair all falls out, it starts to grow again, then you have it again and it all falls out. So it's kind of a laugh a minute, really. But I've also had completely unrelated other problems. So my wife and I, at the end of chemo in 2015, thought, let's do the holiday of a lifetime. So we thought, let's go to the Galapagos. But I never got there, because on the flight on the way out, the left eye retina detached. And by the time we kind of figured out what it was in Ecuador and turned around and come back again, it was kind of too late. But then the specialist at St Thomas, hence the sort of jokes about NHS overcrowding, said, oh, you know, lots of people have just got one eye, you'll be fine. And then he looked very carefully at the right eye and said, yeah, it's fine. And then this time last year, that eye went as well. So for a while, I was kind of blind and going through chemo. And that was really horrible. Yeah, that was awful.
Is it a sort of defence mechanism that you're sort of jokey about? Is this a way of...
My wife doesn't like it sometimes. She thinks I'm too jokey about it.
Because she's suffering as well as you, isn't she?
It's actually worse on her, I think, and the children than for me. I do like to make a joke of it. And if you don't, you slightly go mad. And C.S. Lewis said, humour is God's gift to make us, to help us make sense of a bad, mad world, which I think is true. But I'm not sort of whistling in the dark. I, I, honestly do trust God that he's doing this, you know, for his own purpose. I don't know what it is, but, and I'm not being funny here, maybe one purpose is that you could be here tonight and hear my story. I don't know. But yeah, so I had all these challenges with my eyes. I've just started driving again, so you might want to give me 10 minutes, kind of grace. Yeah. I only hit three people on the way here, so I think it should be all right. It's actually amazing how low the legal requirements are for eyesight to drive. Yeah. But no, I do wake up every morning, and the first thing I think is, thank you, God, that I'm alive, and also, which obviously you don't feel in chemo, but you feel in general, thank you that I feel good. And yeah, just spending time with the children. You know, I mean, this may sound stupid, but a friend of mine who had cancer said she suddenly realised how blue the sky was. Yeah, and it is, not now, but... And so just small things like, you know, the sun coming out, sitting in the garden reading a book or something. It's amazing. Yeah, I just feel so happy to God that I'm alive. Yeah.
But you are going to die. We all are, but, it, you know, the clock is ticking for you. Jeremy, when people, you know, like after Saturday, I don't want to be insensitive at all, but people talk about, oh, you know, I've gone to be an angel or a star or this, and there's a sort of sentimentality about death, and also, to be honest, a sort of wishfulness that, oh, everybody's going to be all right. But the Bible doesn't teach that. The Bible teaches heaven and hell, doesn't it? And it's not just the sort of mass murderer who goes to hell.
Yeah.
None of us deserve heaven. When we hear that eventually Jeremy Marshall has died, can we be certain that you'll go to heaven? That you know that that's where you will have gone? Do you know that when you die, you know, don't look forward to the process of dying, but do you know that all will be well when you meet God?
Yeah, I'm absolutely 100% convinced.
How can you be certain?
Because I believe that Jesus rose from the dead. So my faith may go up and down, but the key thing is not the strength of our faith. And maybe you're here with lots of doubts and questions and stuff, and that's okay. Most of the people in the Bible had doubts and questions. The key thing is not how strong is my faith. The question is how strong is the thing I've got faith in. Mm. And Jesus Christ defeated death. That's why I'm a Christian. That's why I'm unutterably convinced that, yeah, when I die, that moment, I'll open my eyes and see Jesus Christ. And that's not because I'm some super spiritual person. I'm not. You can talk to my wife if you want a few details on that. But that I'm really 100% convinced that Jesus did rise from the dead, which means also he's defeated death. And in Revelation, which is the last book in the Bible, John has a vision of Jesus, and Jesus says, puts his hand on John and says, I'm the first and the last, and I hold the keys of death and hell. So, you know, we could walk out of here and get run over by a crocodile crossing Banstead High Street. We could be on London Bridge. You could have a lump and, you know, a friend of... Well, it's a bit morbid, but it's the truth. A friend of Jeanette's, her husband, 2 weeks ago, said, oh, I don't feel so great. I think I'll go to bed early. She came up late and he died of a heart attack, 62. Yeah. So each one of us, we don't know. And death is a terrible enemy. But if you put your trust in the Lord Jesus and you believe that he really is God and he really did rise from the dead, then God says, yeah, you'll be with me when you die. And that is not on the basis of anything we do. And the biggest misunderstanding that people have about the Christian faith is it's for good people. It's not. It's for bad people. The Christian church is not a kind of Hogwarts where everybody is sort of super brainy and does amazing things. It's like the Marsden. A church is like a hospital. It's basically for sick people. And only when we realise that actually we are alienated from God, our relationship with God is broken, and we will never be happy, we will never be fulfilled. In fact, we will be God's enemies, and God eventually will say, okay, you've made your choice, go away from me. We have to get right with God. But God, the wonderful news is, friends, and otherwise life is kind of depressing, and yeah, if you're terminally ill, it's particularly depressing, I can tell you, is that God didn't leave us in the mess that we're in. He didn't leave us in a sinful, flawed world with terrorists and cancer and family breakup and redundancy and all kinds of things. No, he sent his son into the world, and he came into the world to die. And through his death, there is a way to be made right with God. It's a free offer. There are no conditions. You don't have to reform your life first. There is a cost, which is you have to follow Jesus. But the most important thing is just to come as you are. And if you
believe and you put your trust in Jesus, then all the things that we've done wrong, and trust me, I've done a lot, and I think we would all admit, if we're honest, that we have done lots of wrong things. God puts them all behind him, and when he looks at us, he sees his son. So the offer of Jesus is eternal life, and that's what Jesus also offered when he was on earth 2,000 years ago. In fact, he didn't say only that he offered life. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. So,
Well, no sin will be allowed into heaven. You said you are a sinner, but you believe because when Jesus was on the cross, he paid for sin, you are forgiven.
Yeah.
But your confidence is in what Jesus has done by his death and resurrection.
Yeah, that's what I meant by, it's not about, everybody has doubts, and again, I don't want to position myself as some person who just kind of sails through cancer, not at all. It's really difficult and tough, and I wish I didn't have it.
Mm.
But if we put our trust in Jesus, he can bear any level of trust, any level of faith. And I would compare it, this is not in the Bible, but I think it's true. I would compare it to, imagine there's a frozen lake in a wood, okay? And Roger looks puzzled, wonder where this is going. Yeah, so imagine there's a frozen lake, you're out for a walk in the wood, and there's two of you. And one person is very, very confident, so they go charging and throw themselves onto the ice. And the other person, and maybe some of you are like the other person, is very cautious and thinks, well, I'm not really sure about this. So they kind of hold on to a tree and very cautiously lower themselves onto the ice. But the question is not, how do we get onto the ice? And obviously that's God, that's Jesus. The question is, can the ice hold? And in that case, it doesn't make any difference if you go running on or lower on. But what you have to do is you have to get on it one way or another. And that means coming as you are, coming with all our faults and sins. We can't bring our sins with us and keep them. We have to be genuinely sorry and say, look, I've got things wrong, God, forgive me. But God, he's there, he's welcoming us. That's the story of the prodigal son, which is a very famous story in the Bible where the younger son...
On Monday, the talk apparently was about that. I didn't see it on it, somebody else did.
Yeah.
Do you think having cancer and having, you know, this sort of, you've got 18 months to live, sort of, has it made you regret wasted years in the past? Do you have a different view of what happened before?
That's a tough question. To be honest, not really. Maybe it should, Roger. I don't know. I wish I'd, and I'm so grateful to have this chance now. I wish I'd spoken more about my faith to my friends, because I think being a Christian is a bit like having a cure for cancer. I mean, it would be bonkers if I discovered in my laboratory, which I haven't got, a kind of cure for cancer, and I just administered it to me and didn't tell anybody else. I mean, that would be insanity, wouldn't it? That would be so unkind. But Christian, we're kind of like that, aren't we? We have got more than a cure for cancer. We've got the cure for all the sickness and sin of this world. So there's one thing I wish I'd been bolder in telling my friends about it. Yeah.
Are you afraid about the chemotherapy in the next week or two? Are you fearful?
Yeah, I don't really look forward to it. Yeah, I mean, thank God it's been okay so far. I mean, it's not the most pleasant experience, but it hasn't been, you know, hasn't been so terrible as we had a lady in our church actually who said, which is sadly what happens, she said she'd rather die than go through more chemos. The side effects were so massive. So there are unpleasant side effects, but it hasn't been so bad. What typically happens is that all the white cells and platelets and everything get wiped out, and the sort of oncologist cheerily plots these on a graph. And if you go in on the regime I'm in, you go six times over like 20 weeks, so every 3-4 weeks, and basically you just go like that, like that, like that. And by the end, then probably, which happened last time, you end up in a kind of isolation because you just pick up every conceivable bug imaginable. So you feel like you have Ebola because everybody who comes in has to be kind of gowned up and stuff, and they give you blood transfusions and everything. But so apart from that, it's fine.
Do you miss banking?
No, not at all.
You don't at all?
No.
Do you ever go back to talk to your colleagues?
No, not really, no. I see them socially, but yeah, nobody on their deathbeds says, I wish I'd spent more time in the office. So for those of you who are really career-minded, you know, it's nothing wrong with the Christian faith is not about kind of renouncing the world and going to live in a monastery. No, work is good, but if we make it our God and we make our whole life oriented towards being successful and making lots of money and having a nice house and a car, it will not satisfy us, and we'll realise at the end, actually, that was a wrong priority.
I'm sure there'll be loads of questions, Jeremy, that people will want to talk, and probably some people feel frustrated that I haven't asked the one that they've got in mind, but you will stay around afterwards, won't you? I'm going to ask us all in a moment to show our appreciation. We are very grateful. But I think because it's been quite a heavy sort of interview. Why don't we have a little intermission in a moment, and I'll ask Andy over here, who's a brilliant musician, to play a bit of background music, and then we'll come together in 2 or 3 minutes afterwards. But shall we show our appreciation to Jeremy? Thank you very much.